Hello, and welcome to the Learn Gray podcast. I'm your host, Jenny Schmidt.
Hi, Cody.
Hey, Jenny. How are you?
Good. Welcome. And I just want to say thank you so much for agreeing to be on this podcast today and tell your family's story about navigating dementia with your mom.
Yeah. Thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm really excited to get the opportunity to share my story.
Yeah. So Cody, we met each other, I think it's last summer now. And, you know, you were kind of in the midst of a lot of confusion around what the right thing was to do and how to get it done with your mom. And, you know, since then we've become friends, and I've continued to participate in your family's journey with your mom. And I have felt since the first day that your story was, number one, so heartbreaking, but also just a very distinct and poignant illustration about what so many families go through while navigating any type of cognitive impairment with a loved one. And so through a lot of discussion and maybe some, you know, strong arming on my part, you've agreed to come on and tell your family story today. And I just want to tell you how grateful I am that you are willing, because I think by shining a light on these things, it's the only way we change the world.
Absolutely. After like years and years of confusion and many dark days and so much anxiety, I'm so pleased that we had the opportunity to find you and that we were able to get the help that we needed. So yeah, like you mentioned, I'm one story of many, many people that are going through very similar things that I've been struggling with for years. And just trying to find the right path. So I'm really excited to be able to tell my story and help others.
Awesome. Well, let's, I guess to start out, let's go back in the time machine. And why don't you tell us what life was about like growing up in your house and, you know, kind of who your mom was to you, as a kid.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm 35 now. So I was growing up, coming of age in the 90s, early 2000s, grew up in Rapid City, South Dakota. My mom, Carla Malik, my dad, Tom, and my sister, Cassie, and I, we were kind of that sort of quintessential American family, you know, traditional. My mom had the opportunity to stay home with us while my dad was, quote unquote, the provider. So he, you know, worked hard, provided for the family, but the sort of child development that both my sister and I went through, you know, my mom was at the center of that. She was incredibly charismatic, caring, warm, gentle, tough when she needed to be tough. She was an amazing mom and is an amazing mom. Whenever, you know, we would go to the store, we would go anywhere. We couldn't get out of the you know, the place we went without stopping and talking to at least 20 people. She was incredibly, you know, put together, fashionable, you know, kept the house spotless. Our house was always spotless. She was the type of person who was so energetic and, you know, never sat down. I can't remember one time, unless it was Sunday night, you know, we would sit down and watch a show for an hour, but otherwise she was cleaning up, mowing the lawn, doing the garden, driving us from, you know, X, Y to Z. So, or taking her dogs for a walk. She loved her dogs, still loves her dogs more than, anyone I've ever known who could love dogs. She's obsessed. But yeah, she was just an amazing mom and still is.
You know, now, you know, your mom has pretty severe cognitive impairment at this time, but, and knowing her, only knowing her, I guess, in this phase of her life, I think that still really translates how, nurturing and caring she is. And especially, you're right, like when the dog comes to visit, it, her whole being just lights up, you know, all around her. And it's very clear to me how much she adores her kids, you and your sister Cassie, and how much joy her role as a mom has brought her and still does today. So all right. So you grow up, you have this sort of, you know, Mrs. Cleaver mom, right? Who's the everything. And then Cody, you and your sister grow up and you transition off to college. And what was that like?
Yeah, no, that was shocking for, you know, someone, you know, when you're 18, you're not really realizing, you're like, okay, I'm going to college. What does this really mean? But it really hit me and still is like seared into my brain of them, you know, driving away as I'm sitting in a dorm room by myself. And I'm like, wait, now I'm all on my own. And so that was shocking, a similar situation that I'm sure many people go through. But now it was, okay, well, I'm not going to see my mom every night. And, mm-hmm. and now, you know, she's, you know, way away from me. It's going to take, you know, a lot of effort to get to her. So as I progressed through college, as my sister progressed through college, we started to see her more in phases, in, you know, once every 3, 6, 8 months. Mm-hmm. So there was large chunks of time that would pass. And after college, I moved to Minnesota. So did my sister. So, you know, we just didn't get to see her as much anymore. And that was hard on her, and it was, you know, hard on us or different on mm-hmm. us. And, I just felt like she started to decline in phases that we started to notice.
So what was like, you know, what was the first, moment that you can consciously remember, you know, between in your family or to yourself even, where you're like, you know, something isn't quite right here, that there might be something more going on than just normal forgetfulness or behavior changes? What was that moment for you?
Yeah, so there was kind of two behavior changes that really popped to my mind when you asked me that question. And it was, she would call me every day, you know, from until I was, you know, in my mid-20s, I would say. She would call me every day and just check up and see how my day went and see how things went. Mm-hmm. That started to trickle off, and where she would call maybe once a week, or she would call, you know, she would say, hey, I'm going to call you, and then not call me. And it was like, well, that's strange. She, you know, but I thought maybe we were just growing apart and it was just kind of a natural way. And then the other one was at her job. She was always like really good at selling things to people. She worked at Eddie Bauer in the mall, and she would develop relationships with her customers. And she was always like a really good salesperson. She would always, you know, connect with people, find them the right things. Like people knew her, and she was really good at that. But then, you know, I got a call, and I found out that she was working in the back room now. And I was like, well, that's weird. But she seemed to like it. She seemed to like, you know, going to work. She seemed to like what she was doing, I guess. But, and then mm-hmm. she would start to say, like, she was so angry with work because they would call her and want her to come to work right away. And now that I'm reflecting back on it, she was forgetting her schedule and she was supposed to be working. And mm-hmm. so there was all these like little signs that were like, not super noticeable, or they didn't hit you in the face, but they were just like little breadcrumbs to things that were, you know, starting to deteriorate.
Sure. And, you know, your dad at this time, like he's living, you know, they're living together in the same home. And is he confiding in you at all about any of it? Any of the changes?
No, not really. So I think an important thing here is that my dad would work days and then my mom would go and work at the night. So I don't know mm-hmm. if he was noticing what was going on either. And mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think obviously if you start to notice things, you start to try to deny kind of what's happening as well. Like, no, that can't be the problem. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, and I also think, you know, sometimes it's the person that's the closest that lives with the person who's having the difficulty, where it's like the frog that gets boiled slowly, where these changes are so gradual, not always, but a lot of times they're really gradual. And so you sort of explain it away, you know, and you don't realize like 6 months ago it was this way and now it's different. And so you can miss it, you know? And then I also think that there's, especially in marriages, I experience a lot of one spouse trying to protect their dignity and trying to put forth this image that nothing is wrong. Just because that's what you do for each other. You know, that's as married people, that's our job, right? It's to put our best foot forward and to protect our partner, you know, sometimes at all costs. And sometimes it can be detrimental because by the time you do seek help, it's, you know, things have deteriorated pretty badly. So then you start to notice these changes. And then when did your journey with giving this a name and a diagnosis like really begin for you? How long did that take?
Oh my gosh, it feels like it took forever. In reality, it probably took, I don't know, anywhere from 3 to 5 years to really get our arms around what was going on after sort of bouncing around. So it all started, my aunt Sharon had taken my mom to lunch and called me kind of in a panic and sent me a picture of a receipt that my mom had tried to fill out. And it was literally scribbles. She couldn't figure out how to, you know, calculate the tip and sign her name at the bottom of a receipt. And my aunt had grabbed a picture of it. And that ended up becoming kind of the, like, oh my gosh, there's something seriously here. Oh, and another thing I forgot to point out, at this same time as all of this was kind of coming to a head, her father passed away, which her dad was like a rock to her. I mean, what meant more than anything, she like loved her dad, but he got cancer and passed away. And so it was hard to know during this time, this rocky time, was it like, was she suffering from, you know, acute, you know, anxiety, depression? It was maybe consistent with some of that behavior, forgetfulness, you know, her life was changing from that perspective. So, fast forward, then my aunt, you know, calls me with this receipt and starts going to those details. And, you know, many people were starting to say, okay, we got to do something. There's something wrong here. Something's gotta be addressed. So, you know, where do you start in that situation? And, you know, we went to our primary care doctor who essentially kind of excused away anything, chalked it up to the anxiety and depression, recommended that we drink some herbal tea. And it was like, okay, well, I feel like this is way bigger than this, but what we were being suggested seemed, you know, wildly inadequate to what we were seeing happen every day. But what that did is it gave my parents the permission structure to say, leave us alone. You are overblowing this. Your mom is going through a hard time. Many of that then just got reflected and they began to, you know, go inward, and that it just kept giving them fuel for that. So then, you know, fast forward maybe another 6 months to a year, things continue to deteriorate. We go and get an MRI. Nothing back from that. So again, more ammunition and leave us alone. We're fine. You're the crazy ones. Leave us alone. And then fast forward and again, another 6 months and COVID hits and everything shuts down. Nobody's talking to anybody and everything continues to deteriorate. So
How did that feel? How did that feel for you and your sister? Because it seems like that would be super isolating, not only for your parents, but also for the kids, like to be, you're kind of X'd out at that point of collaborating on anything meaningful related to your mom.
Yeah, no, it was such a roller coaster of emotion for me. You know, you're trying to manage your own life. I don't live there. I don't see them every day. I'm still like in my early 20s, just trying to like figure out how do I transition into the things that I want for my life. But I'm stuck in this quicksand that keeps pulling me deeper in. And I just feel like, you know, the water is rising and it's coming quick. And I just continued to feel like it was just this huge, humongous ball of wax to try to deal with. And I couldn't get anywhere. So many like anxiety was always at its highest level. It was so hard to deal with because I felt like, I just felt like there was, I was just, something bad was going to happen at every turn. Every call that I would get, I felt like, you know, something bad will have happened. So it was incredibly isolating.
And then what is your dad, how is your dad dealing? I mean, do you have any window into how your dad is, I guess, performing as a caregiver during this time? And is he starting to struggle?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting point to highlight. My dad was, like we talked in the beginning, he grew up in a time where his role was to be the provider. And like that's how he was programmed, was I know how to provide for the family. But the soft skills of nurturing, paying attention to little details, while I feel like he had the best intentions, those were not where his skill sets were and what he was really capable of doing. So yeah, we just started to notice things start to deteriorate around the house in terms of keeping things up and, you know, keeping the lawn mowed and keeping things clean. That all just started to deteriorate. And so did, you know, everything else as well.
All right. And so then what happens then? COVID, you know, is blazing. And then what's the next turning point? Or what are you, I mean, I'm assuming throughout COVID, you're still trying to find an answer here or a way to help. And what did that look like?
Yeah. So thankfully my mom's sister Lori was in the healthcare system, and she continued to be a very strong advocate and kept trying to help us find a way. And so finally, you know, we were able to schedule an appointment, granted like 6 or 8 months out, to have a neuropsychiatric evaluation done. Which found that my mom had major neurocognitive disorder, probable early onset Alzheimer's, and was really, you know, at that point, permanently disabled, you know. But we got that diagnosis, and then it was kind of like, okay, like, we'll let your primary care doctor know, but good luck. Like, no one checked up to see, like, how are we doing, or what do we do? Or, like, we got, you know, a whole bunch of, like support groups or like certain things, but I just didn't feel like, I felt like I was kind of trapped in this world of talking to so many people in so many different siloed things that it was like, I had to start to be strategic with how I deployed my time and my energy, because I felt like I was given all of this stuff. And I was trying to run at everything, and everything around me was collapsing because it was just too much. Like, I couldn't, you know, start over and explain something to everyone about what we were going through. And then it would sort of like maybe get some steam, but then it would fizzle out, get some steam, fizzle out. None of these areas talked to each other. So it just felt like I was speaking and nothing happened over and over and over again.
Oh, And I appreciate that. It's a story that I hear so many times of, it's almost like there's no continuity of care, right? So when you get, you know, when you get a diagnosis from, you know, the neuropsych evaluation is the gold standard of diagnosing neurocognitive disorder. But then there's no, and then what do we do? Because every situation is so unique. And I think, you know, primary care doctors are wonderful, but primary care doctors don't specialize in dementia. And, you know, they're the people that are seeing your entire family for family practice generally, and they're not familiar mm-hmm. with what, you know, every single resource that's out there for families navigating a specific thing. And I also think when you get the diagnosis, everybody's in a different place. Like everybody is on a different spot in the journey, no matter, you know, if you're early onset and there's just very minor things, but you're still, you know, driving and doing your life, all the way up to, you know, this is a very long protracted disease process. And so, you know, we just really stink as a society and as a medical profession, a medical profession meeting people where they're at on that journey. So, all right. So, okay. So you get the neuropsych eval, which is great. So now you're armed with the information about what it is, what the thing is that is wrong with mom. And then you kind of reach a pivotal breaking point moment in all of this. And do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, no, this is the moment that, like, we after we got that diagnosis, we just sort of floated out there for probably another year, maybe 2 years, maybe longer. The time all just sort of melds together, and it feels like forever, and it feels like a minute, all in the same thing. Like time just doesn't seem to exist. But after floating out there for a very long time, Cassie and I decide, like, we need to make something happen. We need to do something. So she decides to leave Minneapolis and move back home and sort of provide, like, start to see them every day after COVID is lifted, just starting to be around them, spend, you know, whatever time we've got left with mom and try to make the best memories that we can. So she moves back, and within, you know, 3 months, maybe 6 months, she calls me and she's like, Cody, we have to do something. I don't know what we can do, but we have to do something. And mom is starting to get infections, because she's not cleaning herself, and she's starting to hallucinate, and she's starting to, get angry a lot, and the house is just, you know, really declined, and she is really struggling. And my dad is also just not sure what to do with this situation. It all just kind of feels like everything is blowing up. And so, you know, I just make the decision, like, I've got to go and do something. Like, if this isn't an emergency, I don't know what is, and something's got to happen. So I decide to, you know, after, you know, having a long conversation late last June, I was, you know, just pulled this weekend, a weekend, and it so happened to be the weekend of the rally last year, and the Sturgis rally. And so I venture out, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but I'm going to, you know, force the issue. I'm going to create something. Something needs to happen, and I know that. So I venture out and get to their house, and we're gonna go. I felt like I had no other place to go than the emergency room, because.
And what did you let me stop you. When you got to the house, what did you find at the house, and were you surprised at what you saw?
Yeah, no, her, I'll never forget walking into the house. It was dark, and she was sitting in a corner. She looked sweet as always, but you could tell there was an edge. And, you know, my dad was kind of maybe sitting off to the side, not really paying attention. And me and Cassie walk into the house, and you know, she's hallucinating, and she keeps talking about this woman who's trying to take everything from her. And, you know, it was, the house was really, you know, not kept up. It was dark. It was not kept up. It didn't smell good. So it was like walking into a place that, you know, was very scary, to be totally honest.
Okay. Yeah. So then, okay. Sorry. I mean, I wanted to paint the picture though, because, you know, this is, I think it's important, you know, to understand sort of, you know, what you saw when you got to the house, and then, okay. And then what did you do?
Yeah, no, we, so I think Cassie and I both knew, like, this was the moment of no return after feeling like, because this disease, and just like to take a little caveat here, this disease is so isolating because you feel like there are parts of this that you don't want to share with people because it's deeply personal, and it's deeply, it invades into so many different spaces that you almost feel like you're trying to triangulate a little bit to not embarrass your parents, because they're also brought in a time when it was like, it just feels like it's invading on your whole dignity. So I think Cassie and I realized that this was a point of no return. We needed to go headfirst into this. And we kind of took each other's arms and we loaded them up in the car and told her that we needed to go and get some help for her infection that she was having. And she was, you know, willing to do that. So we pull up, you know, to the emergency room, and I sit her down and I go to the front desk and I say, you know, my mom has dementia and I need help. And I was kind of met with confused looks, like almost angry looks, and basically told, you know, like that I needed to, because she was cognizant or lucid, I needed to essentially call the police to have her arrested in order to get her admitted into the emergency room. And, you know, that was the instruction I was given, but I, you know, felt like, oh, like this doesn't feel right, that I should be bringing people, you know, police into a situation where my dementia ridden mother is, it didn't feel right. It didn't feel good. So we went back out to the car, but I was ready to do that. You know, this was the moment I needed to make something happen. And so we get her into the car, and, you know, during this time, as I mentioned, she was hallucinating. So she would refer to herself in third person a lot. And she just, you know, kept saying, oh, like, I can't believe you guys are doing this. She's going to bolt. And so, meaning she was going to run away from us. And so she was just absolutely livid. We get her into the car. Cassie and I meet at the back of the car, and I'm ready to dial 911. And she goes, hold on. Mom's primary care doctor is just down the street. Let's, you know, go see if she can help us at all before we take this step, because this is a big step to take. And, but I was prepared to do it. So we get into the car, and my mom is actively trying to click the unlock button as I'm driving down the road. Granted, it's Sturgis rally time, so there's motorcycles everywhere. My mom's trying to like actively roll out of the car, you know, yelling at us. And we get to the primary care doctor, and she is so excited to see us because she knew that there had been something happening, but my dad was designated as the main person and main contact who didn't quite know how to navigate all the complexities of like following up with referrals and different appointments and getting on the right path to where we needed to go. So she was very thankful to see my sister and I. And during that time, she mentioned that we should reach out to you, you know, kind of in passing. I kind of took the number and I was like, great, you know, another person to tell my story to. But I put it in my pocket and I was like, okay, off I go. And then we get into the then we get into the car, go back to the emergency room. And I had read somewhere online that like the key phrase to use was that she's a clear and present danger to herself and others. And I felt like that was a true statement at that time. And because I did feel like she was a danger to herself. And so I used that phrasing when I got back to the emergency room, and they were like, oh, well, I guess you found the magic words. And that was able to get me into the emergency room. And so finally, after all of that like commotion and loud, you know, struggle that it took to get there, we finally kind of gotten over that first hump of getting
it's like going through an obstacle course, right? So like you get to the, you know, the emergency room the first time, denied, like you got to find a different way. You take a left, you go over to the primary care. The primary care is like happy to see you, but can't really admit her or tell you. So you're like, you got to take a right there, and then you're back to the emergency room, and then you're trying to weave your way into some actual real help for her.
Yes. No, that's exactly how I felt. It just felt like such a maze that I had no idea where I was going at every turn.
Oh my gosh.
And so I get her into the emergency room. I get her settled. They get her all hooked up to the monitors. I'm sitting there with her. I can tell she's scared. So I try to, you know, comfort her as best as I can. And, you know, we're sitting in there for a couple hours, and I pull out the card that has your number on it. And I'm like, you know, maybe I'll just give this a try. I'm just sitting here right now. Like, might as well. No service on my phone, but it goes through. And, you know, you answered the phone. Hi, this is Jenny. I'm like, hi, this is Cody. I am in the emergency room with my mom. I need help. Is there anything that you can do to like get me into your schedule? And you're like, yes. Can you come now? And I'm like, no, I can't come now. I'm in the emergency room, but how about tomorrow? And you fit me into your schedule. And then shortly after we got off that call, I finally got a doctor who, you know, looked me in the eye after all these doctors kept coming in and out and telling me, you know, your mom shouldn't be here. This is not the right place. It's going to an 18-month waiting list to get her into wherever she needs to go. You need to take her home. No one really looked at me and looked at like what I was going through and the struggle that I was in until an amazing doctor, Dr. Tamang, came in. He like put his arm on my shoulder. He could clearly see that I was distressed about this. And he acknowledged that my mom was having this infection and that it warranted getting some help. And so we got admitted on observation off of that. And I just felt like finally, after struggling back and forth and continuing to try to just push, I got into that first, gotten over that first hurdle and got her into the room, got her settled. And I just like remember going back to my sister's apartment and just collapsing because I was so tired from all that I'd been put through that day. It was a lot.
You just like ran a dementia marathon, right? Trying to get help for your mom. And instead of caregivers actually giving care, which is what we're supposed to do, we're supposed to care. You were met with caregivers who were annoyed that you were even there. They were annoyed that you brought a dementia person to their emergency room because that's not an emergency. And you had to basically, like, you lucked out in getting the emergency room doctor you did and that you had the primary care provider that you did. And it's just crazy. Like, I think about everything that you went through, Cody, and I literally think it's a God thing how all of that worked together, because there's so many times that people do exactly what you did and they end up going home with their loved one without any assistance. And so the fact that you got that done, good on you, because that is it's almost like you won that battle. And so few people make it through sort of that gauntlet to get their person, to get their loved one admitted. So
I feel incredibly lucky. Yeah.
So then what? We get together the next day, is that?
Yes. So after like collapsing at home and like finally getting some sleep. I just wake up the next morning and I'm like, Cassie, I don't know where we're going from here and I don't know what it looks like, but I've got this appointment with this Jenny person and I'm just going to go there and I'm going to tell her my whole story. I'm not going to, sugarcoat anything. I'm not going to hide anything. And I'm just going to lay it all out there. And she said, great. So she went off to work. I came to your office. I'll never forget, punching in the little box to get into your door. And then you kind of saying, come up the stairs. So I walk in, the door swings open. There's like this long staircase. If any of the listeners have been to your office, it's an L-shaped stair that kind of goes up there. And it's, I hear you at the top saying, come up. And I'm the last door on the left or the first door on the left. And I feel like I'm like following the stairs up. And I walk into your beautiful office, the sunny, room. And the relaxing music, and you kind of emerged, and it was just like it was just to paint the picture. It just felt like I was just like finally walking into a place where I felt comfortable, and it gives me tingles still to kind of think about it, the what that was like. So then we proceed to sit down, and I lay out my whole story. You listened extremely intently, looked me in the eyes, acknowledged me, which I didn't feel very acknowledged by very many people on the journey. So I felt a sense of, relief a little bit. Yeah, and I felt like it was really nice also to, you had mentioned, or I can't remember if it was you or me, but we started trying to connect after we were done. And you had given me like a very detailed list, and you had mentioned that you went to Stevens High School and I went to Stevens High School. You were in the military. My husband was in the military. And, we felt connected because we were both in the queer community. And I immediately felt like a sense of relief from that as well, as just feeling like some bit of relief there, which was very nice. And
Yeah, it is
I just
like,
remember
I
that.
think being part of the queer community too, it's like an automatic family ticket, right? You just feel this sense of like community together, and like you can be vulnerable, and you can trust the trust. It just comes with an unwritten sort of code of trustworthiness, So yeah, I mean, it was just such a, it was really hard for me. The visit with you was difficult for me because it was so obvious to me, the amount of emotional distress and pain that you were in at that moment. And I distinctly remember, I'm listening to your story and I'm thinking to myself, like, how many times has this poor man told this same story and nothing happened? Like, nobody helped him. And it's almost like you walked in and you're like, I'm exhausted and I don't want to tell this story again, but I'm going to give it one last shot. Like, I'm doing it one more time and we're going to see if it does anything.
No, I immediately felt just so relieved and connected to you. And I felt like you got me and knew who I was. And you gave me a list of things that I could actively go do that day. And you like sprung into action. And I kid you not, within like no time, I felt like we had moved the ball further than I had ever, been able to move the ball. And I felt like I was, just given some guidance from someone that wasn't in the system, helping me understand, like, I feel like in healthcare, there's such an asymmetric information where you just are forced to listen to whatever it is that the hospital's telling you you need to do. You can't really push back because you don't feel like you've got that sort of agency to do that, because you have to just defer to whatever they tell you to do. And you put me in the driver's seat and told me, this is what you can do here, and this is what we need to do here. And you just sort of quarterbacked the whole situation, and you made me feel, it was such a relief to feel like I was in control of something.
And I think that's what advocacy, like at its heart, what it should be. It's taking what is, like the current situation of what is, and it's through a process of what is and turning that into what it should be, right? So what is not working. What the current situation is not good, right? And it's turning into how it should be. And so I think like when advocacy, like at its core, is really like bringing in somebody who can do what you just said, like quarterback, but also collaborate and also be a truth teller and a witness to like what is happening. And through that dynamic, not through like, you know, I don't light a torch and go, you know, march on the hospital, or, you know, I just say, okay, here's the situation we have here, and here's where we need to get to. And in that situation, it was really clear that your mom can't live at home anymore. Like, she needed to go to assisted living like ASAP, because your dad was completely exhausted and worn out, and he couldn't do it anymore. He couldn't do it on his own anymore. And she needed a place that offered 24-hour care and supervision, like yesterday. So, you know, the other thing is census numbers at those assisted livings and skilled nursing or whatever level of care, those things change every day. And you were told, how long, what were you told at the hospital about that?
The 18 months it would take to get her into wherever she needed to go.
And how long did it take us to get her in?
About 30 minutes.
So that, I mean, to yeah, me, that was like,
Oh, oh my gosh. Like you just, like I said, sprung into action and like were texting me, and I felt like you were so responsive and you were so comforting in that moment, right when I needed you. I felt like, you know, it mm-hmm. wasn't like I was just a number. You sensed the urgency of the situation and you met that moment exactly as I needed you to. And it was tingles.
I love it. So your mom is still at that same assisted living today, and your dad is, you know, visiting, and Cassie and the dog and you, and, you know, the facility's completely in love with her, like that she's just a delightful person to have there. And, you know, but that's just such a small part. Like that's, you know, the success of it took a little bit of time. Your struggle took forever to get to this place. And so, you know, over the months after the Sturgis motorcycle rally / emergency room crisis / assisted living admission, we've had the opportunity to just kind of come together and talk about, you know, the struggles of families everywhere struggling with dementia. And you really felt strongly in your heart that you wanted to do something to give back. And tell us about that.
Yeah, no. So this has been something that has just been brewing in my mind, because there's such an unmet need for people to get the help that they need. And after kind of experiencing that moment that we just went through, I feel very in my heart that there's such an opportunity to not only community build, but get the opportunity to remember my mom as sort of the person that she was, and always kind of have an annual opportunity to do that. And, you know, create an opportunity for everyone to be able to access the help that I did, sort of regardless of where you come from, who you are. So we want to have an annual sort of walk or remembrance 5K opportunity for people in this community and everyone else in between to get together and have an annual walk as a remembrance opportunity. We want to call it She's Gonna Bolt. And we're thinking, you know, in that June 15th timeframe of this year, and or that's what we're aiming for. And I'm just so excited for that opportunity to partner
and
with
she's
you
gonna bolt. That's like that's the phrase she kept saying over and over, right? When you and Cassie are walking her in and she's saying she's gonna bolt, talking about herself.
Yes. Talking about herself. And I just thought that like fully encapsulated sort of this opportunity to have a 5K, you know, run, walk, but also shine a light on the struggles that we took to get there, the story, just have that opportunity to, you know, help others and tell them about, you know, the great resources and the great help that you are in the Black Hills. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I had started, a few years before this is a nonprofit called Sequel Incorporated, which, is going to help provide these the very resources that I gave you, provide resources to families who can't afford it, because the families that can't afford it are the ones who need it the most. And so all of the proceeds we decided from She's Gonna Bolt are gonna go toward helping people free of charge with case management as it, you know, around dementia and cognitive impairment. So I think it's so awesome, and it's been so much fun to work with you on this project and really to shine a light, because I think, you know, I think what we have to do is we have to make people care about these families and care about these folks and helping them get to the providers, the treatment and the facilities that they need to be in without throwing up roadblocks all along the way. And so I think it's wonderful. So we'll have a link on we'll put links on our podcast site and a link to the walk in the show notes. But what are some of your, you know, I guess, personal takeaways that you've learned from navigating this with, you know, with your family?
Yeah, no, it's been a long journey, and there's been a lot of downs from this experience, or a lot of dark moments, but there's also been a lot of positive building, as well, a positive things that have happened. I think it's made the relationship with my sister and myself incredibly strong, kind of makes us feel like after we got her to that, assisted living facility, I felt like I was on top of the world. Like I felt like I could do anything after that. So that was just, you know, such a good feeling. But most of all, I'd say the thing is that I struggled for a very long time wishing that this wasn't my situation, or looking at people and being like, oh, I wish that my mom, you know, that I could be going to Christmas with my mom and, you know, she would make my favorite meal again, or, you know, that my mom could show up and do all these things. But I got to this point where I realized, like, this is my path and I need to, you know, figure out this situation. This is my path. That's not my path. I need to live in my reality. And I think that was incredibly important. Just to not wish that my life were different, but really live the moments that I have and make the best that I can. And then the second would be, you know, this is definitely a marathon. It's not a sprint. You're not going to solve everything overnight. There's not going to be one moment and then everything resolves. It's a day-to-day struggle. So you need to pace yourself. You need to give yourself some credit for whatever it is that you're trying to do and not try to be perfect in everything. Because that can be exhausting.
Absolutely.
Those are probably my two biggest takeaways is just, take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And, don't wish away your path.
I think that's so important. You know, the self-care piece of it, I think it's so easy to get lost in all of the confusion, that goes along with supporting someone who's experiencing this. And also, you know, you end up feeling you end up feeling so helpless, which leads to some hopelessness, which then you're like, well, what, I'm not even effective here. Like, I can't even do it. So then it kind of does a number on your whole self-esteem and your identity as being a good son and what you should be doing for your parents. And so like, it can mess with you on so many different levels, I think, in your psyche. So I think it, I do think it's so important, self-care, and also not keeping it inside, you know, finding people to talk to about it, people who are on a journey themselves, whether that's through a support group or, you know, good friends or a good therapist is invaluable, in navigating caregiving. Cody, what are some of your hopes for the future? Like, what do you want to come out of the pain in your story and everything that you've been through? What's your hope for going forward from this point?
Yeah, no, I feel hopeful or optimistic because I feel like a big thing is just getting people pointed in the right direction. And finding the right path. And I think we're doing a really powerful thing here where we're creating, hopefully creating a community where people feel like they can see themselves and create an opportunity for people to share, you know, their experiences through this and create a community where people can, grow from each other and, build a community where people can remember who their loved ones are, their caregiving experiences, whether they're, you know, past or past and present, people just creating a community where people can find the resources they need and tell their stories is really my biggest vision. And creating an opportunity to just remember who my mom was and never lose sight of that. And just create that opportunity for remembrance. So, yeah.
That's so beautiful, Cody. I'm so grateful that you were willing to tell your family's story, you know, through this journey of dementia. And I'm super excited for She's Gonna Bolt, for the walk, and for us just really being able to come together, you know, all the people that have walked this very precarious journey of, you know, dementia. And, you know, there's some joyful parts of it too. You know, I mean, I've seen with your family, some moments where your mom is fully Carla, you know, where she is just like immersed in the happiness and joy of having her kids and around her and, you know, you guys being able to enjoy that. And even, and your dad too, you know, being able to connect with her and, you know, without having all of that heaviness and kind of not knowing what to do to care for her. So that's been really cool to watch. So, you know, my hope too is that we figure it out, right? This isn't rocket science. This is being able to put together resources and places for people to go to get the answers that they need. It's that simple. And for our caregiver community to like turn the script, to have a paradigm shift into how do we not help you, into how can we help you? How can we see you? How can we understand what it is that you're going through, and how do we fix that? Because I think it's I think it's broken, and we got to glue it back together.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more.
Cool. Cody, thank you so much. I will put all of the links to the walk registration and to other dementia resources in our show notes. And anybody's welcome to reach out. And I hope that everybody found this helpful today, but also I hope it touched your heart too, because care for dementia folks and their families is critical. And it's only getting more prevalent. And so we as a society have to figure out how we're going to handle that. And I think we handle it with a ridiculous amount of love and understanding.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I just want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to tell my story. And for all the listeners who have made it to this point, I hope that you've seen yourself or heard your story echoed and kind of in my story as well. And I just want you to know that there's a lot of hope and there's a lot of people out there that care. You just have to find them. So thanks awesome. So much. And
we're
looking forward to She's Gonna Bolt.
All right. Until next time.